Coming up, if a brain scan could help predict whether someone might commit terrible violence, should it be used? Lucky Severson looks at the arguments. And a New York faith-based state of mind. I follow a group that's trying to document every house of worship in New York City, block by block.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. As U.S. officials responded to the events in Ukraine this week, American religious leaders called for continued prayers for peaceful resolution to the crisis. The U.S. Catholic bishops urged Catholics to pray that justice and human rights will prevail. Evangelical and mainline Protestant leaders called for prayers for an end to military aggression. And American Jewish groups expressed hopes that further violence can be averted. They also urged protection for Ukraine's minority Jewish population. Christians around the world this week began observing Lent, the season of fasting and penitence that leads to Easter. At the Vatican, Pope Francis led traditional Ash Wednesday services, sprinkling ashes on parishioners' heads as a symbol of human mortality. This was Francis's first Ash Wednesday as Pope. Next week marks 1 year since his election. He'll be spending his anniversary on a week-long Lenten retreat south of Rome. This week, Francis once again raised eyebrows with an interview in a leading Italian newspaper. He suggested that the Catholic Church could tolerate some civil unions for practical reasons, such as health care and property rights, although he repeated the Church's position that marriage is between a man and a woman. Francis also criticized what he called the mythology that is developed around him. He said, quote, "To portray the Pope as a kind of Superman, a type of star, strikes me as offensive." Francis's popularity does continue to rise, especially here in the U.S., but new research says it's less clear if the positive buzz is having a concrete impact, what some have termed the Francis effect. According to the Pew Research Center, more than 8 in 10 Catholics say they have a favorable view of Pope Francis, but there hasn't been a corresponding rise in church attendance. 40% of Catholics said they attended Mass at least once a week, the same number as a year ago. There also hasn't been any change in the number of people identifying as Catholic, 22% of the public. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened a new session of the UN Human Rights Council with a strong warning about the war in Syria. Ban said both the Syrian government and rebel groups have committed human rights violations of unimaginable scope. And he said the international community must hold the guilty parties accountable. Meanwhile, the U.S. issued a statement condemning threats against Christians inside Syria. A prominent Islamist rebel group announced it will force Syrian Christians to either convert to Islam, pay a large tax, or face death. Before the war, Christians made up about 10% of the Syrian population. Prominent U.S. evangelical leaders spoke out against a new Uganda law that criminalizes homosexuality. The measure, signed into law last week, calls for up to life in prison for those convicted of having gay sex. Megachurch pastor Rick Warren and leaders of the Southern Baptist Convention were among those denouncing the law as unjust, although they reaffirmed their belief that homosexuality is a sin. Critics have accused some evangelicals of helping to pass the Uganda law. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was in Washington this week. At a White House meeting, President Obama urged Netanyahu to advance the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Netanyahu also spoke before the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, a pro-Israel lobby group. He said that if Israel was prepared to accept a Palestinian state, then Palestinians also would have to acknowledge Israel as a Jewish state. Before the meetings, a broad coalition of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim leaders reiterated their support for the peace process. The Dalai Lama led the opening prayer in the U.S. Senate this week, his first time to do so. The leader of Tibetan Buddhism delivered his favorite prayer, in which he said, quote, "May there be joy in the world with harvest and spiritual rest. May every good fortune come to be, and may all our wishes be fulfilled." We have a special report today on research that raises the question, suppose you could scan a child's brain and tell whether he or she might become dangerously violent in the future. Would it be right to have that knowledge? Or what if it were a convicted criminal? Should brain scans help decide whether a convict should be paroled? Lucky Severson has our story on the ethical debate over predicting violence.
There is always the one big question after mass killings at places like the Aurora Theater, Sandy Hook Elementary, Virginia Tech. Could this violence have been predicted or even prevented?
I believe firmly there are things we can do to not just treat violence but also prevent it.
Adrian Raine is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and a pioneer in the field of neurocriminology. He has written a controversial book called The Anatomy of Violence, The Biological Roots of Crime.
It's beyond reasonable doubt now that there is this brain basis to crime. This research at one point was suppressed and ignored by social scientists for lots of ethical reasons, basically. But now we're out in the open with this information, and we can't go on ignoring it anymore.
I have enormous respect for Adrian Raine, and I think he's an excellent scientist. I cannot think of anything more dangerous than his policy recommendations.
Paul Wolpe directs the Center for Ethics at Emory University and is a co-editor of the scholarly American Journal of Bioethics. He, like other scientists, believes neurocriminology is an important new but undeveloped science with serious moral implications.
We find a new scientific technology. We get all excited about it. We think it will answer problems for us. We start to implement it, and we hurt people. I want us to have the ethical wisdom right now to not rush to judgment about neuroscience.
Raine has been studying the connection between the brain and violence in children and adults for 35 years. He says his research shows that the brains of psychopaths have a deficiency in the part that governs feelings of remorse and empathy for the victims.
What we see in psychopaths who are very fearless individuals and who create a lot of harm to society is that they have a reduction in a part of the brain called the amygdala. The part of the brain that's very much involved in moral decision-making, in empathy, in conscience, feeling remorse, feeling guilt, which is one of the reasons they do such terrible things.
In this task, you'll be shown a series of scenarios. You should immediately respond to the question by pressing the yes or no button.
You take normal people, and if you give them a moral dilemma, like, would you kill one person to save five lives? That's a difficult decision for many of us. But when we do the same thing with psychopaths, their amygdala is functioning much less. Then how moral is it of us to punish psychopaths as harshly as we do, assuming that they never asked to be born with an amygdala that was broken?
Two people often can have a lesion or some brain abnormality in exactly the same place, and it manifests itself in completely different ways.
Raine agrees that two people can have the same defect and one might resort to violent crime, the other to violent sports. But he says there are now more reliable biomarkers that should not be ignored.
But you look at the murderer here and you can see a distinct lack of activity in that prefrontal cortex.
So this person is not sensing that raping this person, killing this person is wrong, or that's morally reprehensible.
That's correct.
Raine testified as an expert witness in the trial of Donta Page, who brutally raped and murdered a young woman. His testimony helped get the man's sentence reduced from the death penalty to life in prison.
So defense attorneys are taking scans and saying, can I find anything abnormal in this scan? And if they do, they can hold that up in front of a jury and say, look at this. The neuroscience expert has told us that this looks odd or is different than average. My client couldn't help themselves.
Cut them a break. You know, you can't hold them fully responsible as we do with other people. We're not all equal. And for some individuals, the dice are loaded early in life conspiring to push them into a life of crime.
He sees a real benefit to society when brain imaging can predict which kids are most likely to end up in trouble and then work to develop treatment programs to prevent it. He has twin boys of his own.
As a parent, I want to know, and I think every parent should know, is their child at risk for becoming a violent criminal offender? We'll never be able to predict with perfect accuracy which children are going to become violent offenders of the future. But we have information, some information now, which does tell us that some kids, the odds are raised that they will become a violent criminal offender.
To try to suggest that we could learn something about their brains right now that would lead us to engage in any kind of different behavior towards them is not only problematic and premature, it is dangerous, because we have seen over and over again the power of stigmatizing children.
Where Rain and Wolpe agree is that brain imaging could be very useful in predicting which inmates will commit new crimes when they're released. And there are a few places that need that kind of risk assessment more than the Los Angeles County jail system. Terry McDonald is the assistant sheriff of L.A. County and, until recently, the head of risk assessment for the state of California.
With the state of California, it uses the California Static Risk Assessment Tool.
What is that?
That tool is an actuarial tool that takes information from an offender's rap sheet, their arrest history, and it downloads that information into a database system. From that, it pops out a score for the offender that predicts their risk of reconviction, rearrest.
California has a much more sophisticated risk assessment program than the LA jail system, which has granted early release to over 26,000 inmates so far this year because of extreme overcrowding. Usually these inmates who qualify, for instance, those not in for violent crimes, get released after serving only 40% of their sentence, some after serving only 10%.
If a system has to release early, it should be based on risk. We do it based on percentage of time served, and it's because we're so large. We have 500 inmates coming in and out of the door every day. And to do risk assessments, a manual risk assessment on 500 inmates, takes a lot of people to do that. It'd be very expensive for every inmate in the LA County system to have that assessment done. So it's not done for everybody.
There is research underway, but as yet, prisons are not using brain scans to predict recidivism.
We'll never be able to perfectly predict future violence. But look, let's face it, will it become public policy? In a way, every day we make decisions on which prisoners we release early. Do we lock them up or do we give them community service? And right now, brain imaging research is showing that brain imaging data is giving added value in these predictions.
We in LA County and every other county in California has to get better at how we do risk assessments. It'll be fascinating to learn as time goes on how physiological testing could help as one component of an overall review of an offender. You don't ever want to rely on any one system.
We have to be very, very careful how we use this information, which again is not to say that we might not be able to use this information well, but to use it poorly is so dangerous.
Adrian Rain is a perfect example of how far neuroscience has come and how far it has yet to go before it is a reliable predictor. He says he has some of the same biomarkers of a serial killer, and yet he grew up to be a neurocriminologist. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Philadelphia.
Faith isn't often the first thing that comes to mind when people are talking about New York City, but there may be more religious practice going on than many realize. A group called A Journey Through NYC Religions is trying to search out and visit every house of worship in the city, thousands of them. I followed along.
New York has been called the most secular city in America, but don't tell that to Tony Carnes. He's made it his mission to systematically document all the religious sites in New York's five boroughs, as he puts it, block by block, alleyway by alleyway. He and his team of freelancers have found a lot to document.
New York is experiencing a religious surge.
The project is called A Journey Through NYC Religions. Since they began in July of 2010, Carnes and his team have visited nearly 7,500 houses of worship and other religious sites. He estimates that's more than 77% of them. They interview, photograph, videotape, even draw, and post their articles and other material on their website, nycreligion.info. Carnes says he launched the project because he believed a vital part of New York life was being given short shrift.
I noticed two things. One, that religion was really booming here in the city, and I also noticed it wasn't covered very intensively.
Carnes says for his team, each visit or journey should be an adventure.
Our classic journey is we just go cold. And we try to perfect a sort of like a foreign journalist parachuting in land and making a real sync with people and really getting into the story all in one day. Now, if we find something that's really interesting, we would go down in deep and we'll come back.
On this weekend, we followed along as they focused on the historic neighborhood around Eldridge Street on Manhattan's Lower East Side. In the late 1800s, this was a predominantly Jewish neighborhood where many Eastern European immigrants worked in the garment industry and lived in crowded tenements. In the 1920s, new legal restrictions curtailed Jewish immigration, and the neighborhood slowly became a center for Greek immigrants. Then New York's famous Chinatown began spilling over, and the street took on a distinctly Asian character. Today, Latino families are moving in, as are Muslims from Asia and Africa.
People's faith paths come from all over the world and flow into Eldridge Street from the head of it and then go on down to the end, and you have the history of world religions. Right here.
Our first stop, a Saturday morning service at the Buddhist Association of New York, where monks and nuns in the Mahayana tradition are chanting the Lotus Sutra. Many of the people here are Fujianese-speaking Chinese immigrants. But after talking with some of the leaders, Carnes and his associate, Christopher Smith, learned the temple is reaching out to people from other backgrounds as well. When they visit a site, a Journey's reporters begin with a set list of questions they ask everybody.
What's unique about this place? If you came to me and say, Tony, you should come to our congregation because... Well, what's that because? How do you... Impact your neighborhood or your network of people.
After the Buddhist temple, Smith heads over to the Asafa Islamic Center to catch a Quran memorization class for young immigrants from Bangladesh. Smith is a former bond trader on Wall Street who left business to attend seminary. He now interns at the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem. He says visits like this enhance his faith practice.
Learning the scriptures is important in many walks of faith, and it's a struggle for me as a Sunday school teacher, but to see kids dedicated to studying the scriptures on a Saturday afternoon is inspiring.
Carnes encourages his freelance reporters to practice a philosophy of journalism he calls sympathetic objectivity.
We start off with sympathy right up front. We do move to objectivity, but we tell our reporters, who are from all different walks of faith, as long as you do that, you can write, cover anybody you want.
Carnes is open about the fact that he's an evangelical Christian, but he denies that A Journey is a covert effort to convert people. He says the project has affected his own practice.
I think I've had a spiritual transformation. I still am a believer in Jesus and, you know, and an evangelical Christian, but to me it's a journey in my own faith. A Journey has made me more free to listen to people. And now that may sound like a small thing, but it's actually pretty big.
He says he wants people to value what sets them apart.
We believe that people don't have to give up their faith to relate to others. We want to say, you can talk about your differences. You do the things differently. That's pretty interesting. And we want to show how the interesting things are.
Pluralism doesn't have to mean that everybody comes to the same conclusion eventually. It can mean in a vibrant city like this that there's many experiences that coexist, sometimes on one street or even in a block.
A Journey's members say they've been amazed at how open various houses of worship have been for them, but sometimes they do strike out.
Yeah. I don't think they're here, guys.
I don't think they're here.
At the end of a long day of journeying, the team often reconvenes at a neighborhood restaurant to debrief. For recent college graduate Chloe Nwangu, this has been an opportunity to see how what she learned in school works out in real life.
It's very easy to sort of speak for or assume certain things about religious experiences. But, you know, unless you actually go out and get the word on the street, you can't really speak to that.
A journey's firsthand reporting often turns conventional wisdom on its head. For example, in the fall of 2010, when protests erupted over plans to build an Islamic center near Ground Zero, media outlets and political leaders made certain assumptions in talking about the controversy.
Everybody said there were, you know, 99 mosques in the city. Well, the problem with that figure is we had visited 170 mosques. We knew that was just nonsense.
A journey now has 230 mosques on its list. Sunday morning in the Eldridge Street neighborhood is a vivid picture of how religion in New York continues to evolve. Carnes and his team begin at St. Barbara's Greek Orthodox Church, where the priest is doing rituals to prepare for the worship service to come. This used to be a synagogue. St. Barbara's thrived after its founding in 1926. Now, only a few Greek families still live in the parish, although many come back to worship here on holidays. A few blocks away, the New York Chinese Alliance Church has become one of the establishment congregations. There's a traditional Protestant service upstairs in Mandarin and an English service led by the youth downstairs.
Sing a prayer.
A few blocks beyond that, Lamb's Church illustrates even more changes. The evangelical congregation is holding worship in three languages, English, Spanish, and a simultaneous translation into Mandarin. Pastor Gabriel Salguero, who's president of the National Latino Evangelical Coalition, says religion is often an underestimated part of the city's life.
Faith leaders are thought leaders, just like Wall Street and just like the government. We're one section that influenced thought and the direction of the city.
The final Sunday stop is where it all began, the historic Eldridge Street Synagogue, once the jewel of the neighborhood.
People coming through these doors when it was built 125 years ago were living in very small apartments. It was very dirty and very crowded out those streets here. And as you came in here, you really transitioned to another world.
By the 1960s, the building had fallen into disrepair. But after a $20 million restoration project, the synagogue has become a museum, preserving the history and offering programs to help Jews from other neighborhoods explore their traditions, such as this special event to celebrate Tu B'Shvat, the New Year for Trees. A Journey's members say New York's religious diversity is playing out in similar ways throughout the U.S.
I think we're a microcosm of intense interaction, but it happens in a healthy way across the country.
And Carnes says he hopes documenting the challenges, celebrations, and uniqueness of New York religion can be a model for elsewhere.
There are many things, they're not going to agree on everything, but to live with each other, value each other, to cherish each other, and to say, well, in these areas where we do agree, we can do something for the sake of the city. And if we can do that here in New York, then I think we actually have a paradigm that can work in Cairo, have a paradigm that can work in Mumbai.
Finally, for Ash Wednesday, many churches tried to find new ways to incorporate ancient Lenten traditions. Father Leo Patalinghag, the cooking priest, created a series of YouTube videos with recipes for people who've given up meat for Lent. The videos highlight Catholic Relief Services' work with the poor. For Christians with a super busy schedule, many congregations offered ashes to go, and some even offered drive-through service, which they called Ash and Dash. Many churches encouraged Christians with ash marks to post selfies on social media sites. There were clever hashtags, including #ashtag and show us your ash. Some complained that was inappropriate for the solemn period of Lent, but others praised any attempt to get people excited about their faith. That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where I have a fan page, too. You can watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit our website, where there's always much more, and where you can also listen to or watch each of our programs. Join us at PBS.org. As we leave you, more scenes from Ash Wednesday.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.